Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This is Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Well, hello.
Hello. Summertime and the living is easy. Here we are, episode 3.
Cheerful existential summer.
Yeah.
Cheerful summer existential.
I'm excited about this because it's something I think is at the heart of human existence. If you want to define what separates us as human beings, our relationship with music has to be one of those things. And we're talking to one of my favorite music writers. She used to write for The Word magazine, which 10 or 15 years ago, I loved it as much as I loved magazines like Smash Hits when I was a kid. It was like, almost like Smash Hits for grown-ups. And she has subsequently gone on to do great interview pieces and music reviews, and you'll often see her stuff on The Guardian. And she's written a fantastic book. It's called The Sound of Being Human, How Music Shapes Our Lives. She is Jude Rogers. And it's a great conversation.
Yeah, it really is. And music is my late in life discovery, Jeff, isn't it?
I know. You know, you as you've been telling us, you had your Glastonbury moment, you had your Sam Fender moment, you had a little dance with Taylor Swift.
I've got an ABBA Voyage thing coming up.
Yeah.
On the dance floor, no less. What costume do you think I should go in? All white?
I can't think which video.
Is that the Waterloo costume, isn't it?
Yeah, I was also thinking there's a very fetching unitard Björn wears in one of their videos. Maybe something like that could look good on you.
What is a unitard?
Full body leotard sort of thing.
Is that like a mankini?
I think it leaves a little more to the imagination.
It's a less revealing version of the mankini.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, do you think I would get attention if I went there, actually, went in that?
I think you'll get attention anyway, and you would get a very different kind of attention if you went in it. Give it a go.
There's not anything particularly ABBA-related I should go in.
I didn't go in any ABBA-themed clothing when we went, but I wasn't as brave as you. I had a seat. I thought, at my age, I don't know if I can stand for the full hour and 20 minutes or whatever it is.
In the time, I mean, it's worth saying about this, that you were, as always, incredibly helpful. It was my wife texting you saying, should we go and sit down? Should we go to the dance floor? We then havered around. Anyway, we were buying returns and the returns of the seats went. So the decision was made for us. So we ended up on the dance floor.
It's meant to be.
Exactly. The other thing about Jude Rogers, which we cover in the interview, is she did interview me for GQ.
She did.
About my book.
I spoke to her on Background about you.
Yeah.
Off the record.
Yeah. And her book is really nice and very summery.
It is very summery. It's a memoir. There's some sadness in it, but there's a lot of the joy of music. But also, she talked to a lot of experts, neuroscientists, psychologists, and so on, to try and dig a bit deeper into what our relationship is as human beings with music. And it's a really good read.
You're listening to Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
We're delighted to be talking to writer Jude Rodgers about her new book, The Sound of Being Human, How Music Shapes Our Lives. I can vouch for this personally because it is the book I took on holiday with me when I finally got some time for leisure reading this year. It was my number one choice. It's structured around 12 songs that each tells us something about the power music has on us. And importantly, it is a memoir. Jude traces her life through music and shows us how tightly bound up songs can be with memory and shaping formative moments in our lives. And here she is, Jude Rodgers. Hello.
Hello, Jeff. Hello, Ed. Thank you so much for having me on. I'm delighted.
Hello, Jude. You haven't actually mentioned, Jeff, that Jude is also an interviewer.
This is true. Jude interviewed Ed for, was it GQ magazine, Jude?
It was, yeah.
I got a text message sounding you out.
Yeah, you did. And basically, let me just say, this title of this episode, Jude, is going to be Jude versus Ed, the rematch. No, you and Jude, you're very nice to be interviewed by you.
What was Jude's technique like as an interviewer, Ed? How did she wheedle stuff out of you?
Far too good. I would say she was the sort of lull you into a false sense of security. Pretend to be your friend, then pounce. Oh,
well, it was hard, Ed, because you're so lovely. And I'm thinking I've got to be an objective person. It was the first big profile I'd done for GQ. You know, it's 3,000 words. And I think they wanted me to be a bit more mean, but I couldn't be because you were just too nice. And we had a lovely walk on Hampstead Heath.
We saw your pond. My pond, as we call it. My pond. I think this is becoming too much about me, even for me, Jeff. So maybe should we go back to Jude?
Yeah. Jude, you and I are both, we have quite a similar relationship to music in that it occupies a large space in our lives. And I think that hasn't always been true for Ed. He's somewhat of a late bloomer.
Oh, it's all about me again.
There's a recent awakening. But I wondered if, just to start, you had any thoughts on why music looms so large for some of us, less so for others, and what we could do to nudge Ed into becoming more like one of us. One of us.
Well, I wonder if it's what we're surrounded by when we're little, for starters, really. You know, I don't know, Ed, if your parents played music at home or you had that. But, you know, I'm from your classic South Walian family. Chapel, pub, choir. So, you know, my mum and stepdad are chapel organists to this day. So there was always music at home, but it was generally more classical or folk music, that kind of thing. My grandparents also always had the radio on. So it was just sort of background. My first memory is from their house hearing Super Trooper by ABBA and my grandma and I singing along to it. But also watching off Saturday morning kids TV, which was just awash with fantastic pop stars in the 80s when I was a kid. So I think there's something quite formative about it. If it gets you that young, then you're gone.
Reading the book, I felt like that we grew up in a time where there weren't very many TV or radio channels. Mm. So what came out was kind of for everyone. And also the kind of odd selection of people you would see performing on Top of the Pops, it kind of exposed us to a lot. I think it was a lucky time. But I don't know. Do you feel like you can't, a lot of that just went over your head, Ed?
I'm thinking about this. You see, my parents did play some music. It was sort of jazz, you know, Ella Fitzgerald, Paul Robeson. Actually, also, my mother really likes Edith Piaf. My parents was an older generation, so they weren't a pop music generation. So I wonder whether that was part of it. Because my father was actually quite musical and could sing in tune and everything, something I definitely can't do. So anyway, look, I'm sort of living my life in the kind of reverse order, which is I'm living my 50s in my 20s. I'm now becoming sort of really passionate about music.
It was Taylor Swift, now it's Sam Fender.
Exactly. Now, look, notwithstanding the fact that Jeff has kind of taken me down a peg or two in terms of my musical knowledge, I so enjoyed the book, Jude, and I found it incredibly moving. And it's structured around 12 songs, and the first of those tells the story of you aged 5 and what ended up heartbreakingly being the last time you said goodbye to your dad. Was it hard to write such a personal account?
Yes, it was. He was going to have a hip operation. He had ankylosing spondylitis, and this operation would help him be able to play with me and my one-year-old brother. And he didn't get through the operation, you know, which wasn't meant to happen. So it obviously is freighted with such emotion. And, you know, it was hard to write about that in some respects, but also quite lovely, you know, trying to remember him and his love of music and how that's come through to me. But it's funny, over the years, I have written some things about him in, you know, articles. I wrote a piece for Word magazine, which is the music magazine, long gone now, sadly, that I used to work for, about how sort of male pop stars took his place in some ways, or I looked to them for some sort of, I don't know, delight or pleasure when I was growing up. And that was the start of what became this book. I write about Adam Ant in there, for example, and there's a chapter titled Prince Charming and Adam the Ant. It's sort of cheating because it is Prince Charming plus Freedom by Wham, which... it was a song that, oh, God, it's still one of my favourite songs. I absolutely love it.
I felt so validated by that because I think it's even thought of by some snobby people as a lesser Wham song, and I've always really loved it.
Me too. I get really angry about that.
Yeah, and then I saw that in your book and it made me finally feel vindicated.
Yeah. No, I wanted to be very honest and about the songs that I've loved. You know, it's funny, when I did a launch event for my book and I mentioned Freedom by Wham and some people laughed and I just took them up on it. Wham were brilliant. They were fantastic in a way that I think some people are quite surprised that, you know, I'm a music journalist and I like ABBA and Wham and Talk Talk and Kate Bush. You know, it's, but you know, that's what most people like. You know, I do not like the concept of the guilty pleasure at all. Music is pleasure, whatever form it comes in, whether it be, I don't know, Benjamin Britten's War Requiem or something by Nena Cherry.
But isn't it interesting this? You know, I, for my Desert Island Discs, chose Angels by Robbie Williams.
Yes.
And the reason I chose it is because Justine and I were dating. Oh, I think we'd first started going out with each other and we went to the Live 8 concert and Robbie Williams played Angels brilliantly with like a whole sing-along. And so it meant a lot to me for that reason. And I got, you know, I got absolutely done over for sort of, you know, picking Angels.
But that says more about the way people view politicians,
yeah,
because I think people probably thought you'd been told by the results of a focus group, yeah, to pick it, or you like, it's like Gordon Brown mentioning the Arctic Monkeys.
Yeah, maybe.
No, there's a story behind it. There's a connection behind it. It's absolutely valid. You know, chapter two of my book is the version of Only You by the Flying Pickets.
Ba-da-da-dum.
Yeah, exactly.
Ba-da-da-dum.
Stop singing it, I'll start crying. No, not really.
People cry a lot when I sing, Jude, actually, but not in a good way.
No, but, you know, that is one of the most important songs in my life. And you tell that to, you know, certain music snobs, and they'd be like, oh, why would you write a chapter on that? It's because it's the last song I remember sharing with my dad. And I do love it. And when I think of music, I think of our conversation at the front door when he's going to hospital. Our love of music is about the resonances and the relationships, the connections, you know, whether that be a lot of people singing a song together in a field or, you know, a memory of something that my dad and I shared. And, you know, the song that my dad heard before he died is the song that I can just put on Spotify now and listen to. It's the same thing. And the way that music can carry all these memories and stories, it's just so powerful. And it's powerful for so many people because our brains are wired that way.
Part of what's lovely about the book is that obviously that is such a key memory for you. And that moment underpins a lot of what comes afterwards. But you quite reasonably want to scrutinise your own memory because memories are unreliable, and it's possible that you were making sense of your life and your subsequent passion for music and career in music writing by placing undue emphasis or remembering that moment wrongly because we didn't know you were saying goodbye to your dad in that way.
No. And as I work through the book, you know, I sort of, I don't leave my dad behind. Maybe I do in some ways. But I also go forward, you know, with him sort of behind me, you know, and find my own music and my own songs that mean things to me that are completely disconnected with my relationship with him.
In the book, you don't just talk about your own memories, but you also went off and talked to others to think about the science of all this.
Mm.
Do you want to say something about that and what you learnt most about it? What surprised you?
Yeah, it's funny. People said, "Oh, you could have just written, you know, a book about your own life." And I thought, "No, I'm a journalist. I want to dig into why does this stuff happen." So I just started reading around. I did the early stuff actually when I was pregnant with my son some years ago, now 2013. That was the thing I think that set me off. It was finding out how babies in the womb can remember music. I know that's something that's talked about a lot. You know, people put headphones on their babies and play them music. You know, this whole idea of taking your kids to music classes when they're young, you know, they become really clever. But there was a study in 2013 that proved that babies in the womb could remember a very specific version of Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. And it proved that in the womb, you can form memories from specifically music as opposed to sounds. And I just thought that was fascinating. Rather than just digging through academic papers and stuff like that, you know, I'm not an academic, I'm a journalist. I decided to ring and go and do proper interviews with these people. And what really fascinated me is how many of them wanted to communicate their joy in finding out about how the brain processes music. I really loved finding out how our identity and music is very connected in the more evolved part of our brain. I thought that was really interesting. You know, if you hear a sound, you might think you just react to it in a very animalistic fight or flight way. But when we remember particular songs, all those connections are firing in the very evolved part of our brain, at the front of our brains. And I loved finding out about that. And I wanted to communicate that stuff in sentences that were straightforward and accessible and didn't get lost in scientific jargon.
Sometimes, especially I think with girls and young women, an obsession with pop can be dismissed as a silly and hysterical and a frippery. And I think you write so well, both from a personal point of view and then going and finding out what lies underneath from scientists and psychologists about what pop stars that you have loved, like Adam Ant or Nena Cherry, were able to do for us. So can you talk a little bit more about the role that these stars can occupy in people's lives?
There's loads of interesting stuff about how a pop star can become a focus of our affections, because when we're teens, there's a part of our brain that's developing to make us try and seek new faces of people. And it doesn't have to be a real person. It can be a poster on the wall. It can be, as it was for me, Michael Stipe on a pop video. I was like, oh, who is this man? Speaking personally, seeing Nena Cherry on Top of the Pops, you know, this is late 88. I am 10 and a half. Here's a woman who, her mum was a Swedish artist. Her dad by birth is an African musician. Her stepdad is Don Cherry, the jazz trumpeter. She has lived in New York and been in The Slits, this punk band. She's done all this cool stuff. But I just found something in her as this white girl from Swansea who, you know, was a bit of a swat. And suddenly there's this woman rapping and dancing, and she was heavily pregnant, and just saying, oh, here's somebody who is suggesting other ways of being. And it was just really powerful.
And you start to piece together your own small p politics.
Yes.
Through moments like that.
Definitely, definitely. You know, I see it with children even now. There's a sort of expectation around young girls to behave in a certain way still. I know it's changed a lot since I was a kid. But pop music and pop people can give you different options, different ways for your imagination to be occupied. And also, you know, being a female music journalist, I didn't want to paint myself into an obvious corner. But these are all people who did, you know, quite big things for me. You know, I mentioned the band Kraftwerk, who I loved in my late teens. And that was quite unusual for me because I was your proper Britpop indie girl, really, before I loved them. So these bands have slightly challenged me, or artists that pushed me into different places. I don't just speak to scientists about this. I speak to people who are experts in fandom. I look at anthropology, I look at sociology to try and track how all these things are happening. The thing I've really loved about the response to the book is I've had, there was one week I got an email from a 73-year-old chorister in Swansea. And he didn't know much of the music, but he'd really responded to it. And I think it was the same day I got a message from Cosy Fanny Tutti, who was in the band Throbbing Gristle and is an experimental artist who's done very provocative, explicit work. I thought, fantastic, I've got this guy and I've got this woman. I want people to respond to this with their own set of references. But, you know, it's called The Sound of Being Human because I think it is just something intrinsically in us, for so many of us. In the last chapter, I talk about how during the pandemic, I had about a month or so where just music wasn't giving me any comfort at all. And this was just after I'd sent off my proposal for my book. So I was slightly nervous. And then I read about this condition called musical anhedonia, where there are some people who don't respond to music at all, 5% because of the way their brains are wired. But it's something you're either born with or you get because of a brain injury. I thought that means that 95% of people don't have musical anhedonia. 95% of people, their brains react to music in this way.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
You talk very movingly about your relationship with your dad in the book. You've got a son yourself. Are you passing on... As they say on Radio 4, your inheritance track.
Yes.
To him. I'm looking for some tips here. How do you how are you bringing up your son to give him the love of music that you've got?
Well, having a child really did inspire the book as well. Seeing how he reacted to music when he was very little, you know, just moving his bum in time to the music on the radio or something. You may guess, given I'm a music journalist, I desperately want to influence his music taste. I've played him lots of stuff from when I was a kid. He loves Wham, I'm pleased to report. But he's also liking his own stuff. He loves Push It by Salt and Pepper, which I love, even though there are some rude words in it. He loves Roxette by Dr. Feelgood, which is a strange one. And obviously I'll play him stuff that I want him to listen to. But I think you can't force things on kids, sadly. But his favourite song is Bad Habits by Ed Sheeran, especially the version with Bring Me the Horizon that was on the Brits that he heard somewhere. And I think he's going to be proper metal or something like that, which is slightly terrifying. Not that there's anything wrong with liking that. That's great. A lot of my good friends in music journalism are metalheads. I'm just thinking my ears probably won't be able to take, you know, the volume.
I think just being self-critical, I think part of the problem in our household is that when Justine and I sort of start wanging on about when we first heard this, that and the other, do you remember this? And it's like, you know, it'd be like my parents saying, you know, do you remember in the 1950s?
Yeah.
And I'd have been like, sorry, I'm not really that bothered about what happened in the 19, when you listen to this in the 19. So I think it's partly giving it timelessness, if you know what I mean.
But that's changed. I mean, it gets overstated, but we grew up in an era where the new was what was available to us if you went to a record shop, by and large. Whereas now it's a huge buffet with everything in it. So era matters less.
I agree. I think I make a different point, which is that if you accompany it with some story from that era, yeah. It's a big turn off.
Yeah, I was kind of resistant to listening to my son's tastes, but we've started listening to Radio 1 in the car and I quite like it. You know, it's a bit loud, it's a bit noisy. But I think it's quite natural for there to be that, you know, division as well.
How does your son feel about something which I'm sure you do a lot with him, which is to play him old Labour Party conference videos?
I'd love to do that.
I mean, they're not so keen on that, strangely enough. You know, here's a debate from the 1987 Labour Party conference. I'm very interested in what you say about sort of teenagers' brains. And it's not just teenagers' brains, is it really? Well, there's a sort of freedom and a self-expression that comes from listening to music, which I think it's so important to sort of encourage your children into, isn't it? I mean, it's not just the taste for music we're talking about here, is it?
No, it's sort of expanding your mind in different ways. And I think that's why I wanted to put in, you know, the moment when I realised that I quite liked, you know, the kind of club music that people I was scared of liked. You know, I'm not a clubber. I don't really like crowds. You know, I'm a small music festival kind of person.
I mean, obviously, I'm a big clubber, Jude.
Well, of course. Yeah, you know, you've done Glastonbury more than me.
Well, I'm a big clubber. Yeah, obviously. Fabric.
I've never been to Fabric.
No, I've never been to Fabric.
But you're right about the science of dancing. Both Ed and I are missing the dancing gene, whereas you have it.
But you see, I think we're being too... I think that's part of the problem here, Jeff, isn't it?
Ed told me that he wanted to go to ABBA Voyage, but he was scared that people would look at him and he wouldn't know what to do with his arms.
I'll go with you, Ed. I'll go with you and I'll hide you. I haven't been yet, which is ridiculous. Well, see, I was self-conscious about it when I was younger, really self-conscious, even in school discos. You know, I write about the horror of comprehensive school discos when, you know, I'm Too Sexy comes on. It's just the worst when you're a 14-year-old girl. But I think because I started going to sort of indie discos, which may be more your world, Jeff.
Yeah, I can dig my hands in the pockets of my cardigan and jump around to a Wonder Stuff record.
Exactly.
I think it's more encouraged today. I mean, you know, my son is shortly going to go to the Year 6 disco. I remember going to a disco when I was, I think I've told you this before, Jeff, haven't I? It must have been 16. I think I'd done my GCSEs. All I remember was my white trousers, not good, and Caravan of Love.
Oh, that's a great song.
The House Martins.
That seems like an unlikely track to play at a disco, though.
Oh, near the end for a little, you know, little smooch.
Near the end.
Oh, yeah.
I left at that point. No one was smooching with me. Anyway, sorry.
Me neither, you know, to be honest. I was kind of, the school discos, I liked the songs that let me and my friends just jump around. So I liked, you know, Step On by the Happy Mondays or Come On Eileen, when I was in primary school. I loved that because you just all got to hold hands and dance in and out, and it was just quite joyous. You know, I had a launch party for my book that ended in a disco. It was so exciting.
Where was our invite, Jude?
Oh, I'm sorry, it was in Abergavenny. I thought it might be a bit far.
All right, okay. Fair enough. What did it end with? Come On Eileen.
Oh, do you know, I've got no idea. I think I might have had a few glasses of wine by that point. But my friend Katrin, one of my oldest friends who's mentioned in the book, and I think I'm really pleased that there's so many of my friends just peppered through this book as well. She just played lots of songs from the book and other songs that we used to dance to as kids. And I think with friends, dancing is different, really, because you feel less self-conscious, maybe.
But why do we feel embarrassed about it?
Yeah, it's weird, isn't it?
Why does it... It's like, you know, my angel's point. Why are we made to feel embarrassed, either about our choice of songs or our ability to dance? I mean, the number of people I know who are even more reticent than me to go on the dance floor when they go to a party.
It's interesting. Maybe that's my next book. No, my husband's a great dancer, but he very rarely does it. He needs to have several pints and then he'll do it.
Why is that, Jude?
I wonder if it's something to do with probably something written about extensively in the field of anthropology. You know, a lot of dancing is, you know, rituals and mating and is presenting yourself in a certain way. I think, you know, rave culture obviously changed that, but it did involve lots of, you know, illegal substances for most people as well to kind of loosen them up. But if you can loosen up, it's wonderful.
The book is about what music is to us and the role it occupies in our lives. And I was wondering how specific that is to where we are in culture and history. So obviously, what is more human than music? But if you think about the slice of the pie it occupies, is that dictated by the fact that we have lived through an era of recorded music? And would it occupy that much space if it was 1750 and the only songs we knew were, I don't know, What Would We Do With a Drunken Sailor and One Man Went to Moa? I mean, and some hymns.
How dare you stereotype the 1750s like that? The 1750s are coming back and are
swinging
sort of, and they're extremely angry with you.
I think I mentioned songs from the 1750s in my book, don't I? I have the folk song chapter. Yeah, I think it's funny. David Hepworth, the music writer and my old boss at Word magazine, asked me about this recently. He said, do you think it's because we've been played, you know, we can replay songs again and again and again and again? And I'm sure that's a big part of it. One of the neuroscientists in my book, Kath Loveday, talks about how a kind of song can make a sort of imprint in your memory. And so when you hear the song, that is sort of replayed, but all the sensory information that's happening around the hearing of that song can be taken in with it. And obviously every time we hear a song, and it might have different associations, it might change it a bit. You know, when I hear Only You by the Flying Pickets now, I will think of Ed Miliband singing it to me. But yeah, I think because it has been so much part of the background to our lives, hasn't it? When we go supermarket shopping, we have the hits of the day playing. You know, when we're walking on the street, there are cars playing music. It's a kind of art form that we can just sit and really listen intently to a piece of vinyl or a concert, but we can also just have it, you know, going on around us. You also carry music around in your head, don't you? It's sort of there without you noticing it. But it's just embedding yourself even more deeply into your brain. I think that's really why it's got that power.
Mm. Can I ask about the sort of individual versus the collective experience? Because I was quite struck in your REM chapter that you talk about going to an REM concert and feeling a sort of, one, you didn't love their new album, but secondly, you said that you're having to share the band with other people. And actually part of it is that you're irritated that the other people weren't listening to the music or were just getting drunk. I mean, as somebody who's a sort of late convert to music festivals, I mean, the collective experience can transform it to a whole nother level, can't it?
It can, yeah. It's funny though, as a teenager, that was my first gig that wasn't a festival, actually seeing REM. And because they'd meant so much to me, you know, I'd pored over those lyrics, I'd filled notebooks with my interpretations or what I'd write, you know, what I'd say to Michael Stipe if I met him, which obviously eventually many years later I did as a journalist. You know, I found it quite unsettling because he wasn't a real person. He was this fantasy figure for me. I could mold him and shape him in any way I wanted to in my head. But that same summer I went to Glastonbury at the age of 17. But yeah, that experience like Pulp in a collective in that festival. We were very lucky to be there that year. This was 1995, the height of Britpop, but also the height of the great dance music culture that was going on in Britain at that time. We were just seeing all these people that were having the same reaction as you to these songs and thinking, we're all sharing this moment. It's really powerful. Pulp, it really felt. And this was 95, you know, and I do talk about this quite a lot in relation to the politics of the time, but, you know, it felt like we were coming to the end of our whole lives. I was one when Margaret Thatcher was elected. It did feel like there was change happening. And Pulp, out of all the bands, were the ones I most closely associated with that because they were pretty political. You know, they were about the working classes being recognised and about privilege being wrong. It's quite weird just thinking about writing about that in the book. And, you know, obviously I'm a journalist and I've interviewed all these people and that is weird. And I wanted to write about that as well, how weird that is.
I mean, obviously you have had a chance to interview your heroes, Jude.
Yes. Including you, yes.
Don't indulge him.
Which obviously is great for you. And you also interviewed me. Now, Michael Stipe is one of the people that you did interview. I think you had 20 minutes with him.
Yes. Yeah, 20 minutes is your classic for somebody of that level of fame. And I know, I get why, you know, somebody like him will have done so many interviews over the years. The 20 minutes is more than enough. I haven't read about how music journalists themselves, you know, they're music fans. They become music journalists because they're fans. They want to meet their heroes. So I wanted to be honest about how, you know, I'd barely slept the night before and I really wanted him to be my friend, which is not very professional. But I wanted him to feel respected and I wanted him to be respectful. And he could be quite a tricky character in interviews. I knew that. And thankfully, we got on really well. But, you know, I write in the end of that chapter about how a couple of years later, I go to a playback of the REM album Automatic for the People. And, you know, he doesn't remember who I am. Of course he doesn't. But, you know, that's, I know I get that now as an adult. But that would have devastated me as a teenager. Yeah. Could you sort of form these tight relationships with him?
I mean, I think it is important to say for the listeners that you didn't have a sleepless night the night before interviewing me, Jude.
I was in a very comfy Premier Inn in Archway, I think.
Fair enough. Just for the record,
the bed's very comfy. Yeah, so I slept well.
How do you approach when it's somebody you've idolise who has meant a lot to you in that way. So obviously it's not interviewing a politician, so you're not there to hold them to account. But sometimes it's like a dereliction of duty as an interviewer with a readership or with a listenership, not to ask certain questions that they might not want to be asked. What's your approach?
I just say, you may not, you know, if you don't want to answer this question, it's fine, but I've got to ask you it. Or I say, I used to say when I used to write a lot for women's mags when I was younger, my editor asked me to ask this. I'm very much not from the Jeremy Paxman school of interviewing. I like having a good conversation with somebody and trying to open them up and just be warm and share experiences. I remember interviewing Kylie Minogue. I knew she wasn't going to be terrifying, but because I loved her when I was a kid. And people say, oh, she doesn't say much in interviews. You've got to re-push her. So at the beginning of the interview, I brought up the fact that she's got Welsh family. And we ended up talking about her nine, which is Welsh word for grandma, like a Northern Welsh word for grandma, actually. She had her nine was still alive. And she talks to me about her Welsh family. I got her to say, Llanfair Pwllgwyngyll Gogerych Undrwbwt Llansilio Gogogoch, which is the long train station.
Can you just repeat that for us, Ed?
No.
But I got her to say that, kind of try and let's find some shared ground. If it's, you know, doesn't feel too forced.
Then another side of that is because interviewing is part of your work, reviewing is another part of it. And you write in the book about the experience you had with ABBA, who you love. You had been kind of on the inside. They'd employed you to write the audio tour script for their exhibition. You were trusted by the ABBA camp. And then when the new album came along, you write an honest review.
Didn't really like it.
And that's your job. In that moment, you have to write what you think, and it's a 2-star review. So, I mean, what did it crush your mind at any point? Oh, well, that's me.
Yeah, that's it. Well, I haven't been offered any freebies to ABBA Voyage. No, maybe that's why. No, you've got to be honest. Yeah, the ABBA thing was tough. I wrote about that very late on in kind of quite a late draft of the book, actually. You know, on Twitter, you get people ranting and, you know, you've just got to take it with a pinch of salt, really. But people find in my personal email saying, you hate joy. You hate everything. But what I did on Twitter, to everybody who said, bloody typical Guardian, you hate ABBA, you don't like pop music. I just replied to everybody with a link to an article I'd written in the top 50 songs of all time for The Guardian about how Dancing Queen was one of the greatest songs ever. I just put the link. And in that piece is my love and joy about them.
Don't reply to people on Twitter, Jude. That is the answer.
Yes, yeah.
Don't look at your notifications. Don't reply.
No, you're right.
Honesty is important.
Yeah, you've got to do that.
Can we end on a positive note? Because it's such a positive book and such an inspiring book. And really, I encourage people to read it, to buy it and read it.
Thank you.
Yeah, don't just stand at the bookshop reading it.
If you were to pick one thing to be optimistic about in terms of music and the role it can play in our lives, in our society, in the education of me, it's not all about me, I know. What would it be?
Oh, there's so much. I just think this is a timeless one, actually. Just think about how a song can bind you to other people. You know, I write in the book about how a dear friend of mine, her husband died very young, and how the song Pressure Drop by Toots and the Maytals was one he chose for his funeral. You know, he had terminal cancer, he knew he was dying. And how every time I hear that song now, I think of Pat and I think about how wonderful he was and that gift that he gave us. My father-in-law died recently and we had his funeral the other day, and The Wait by the band was played at the funeral. And I just think about how a song that you share with somebody will just always be there. And it will carry your friendship and love and all these emotions in them. And that's true for any generation. And it's going to continue. You know, my son will have songs like this with me or with his friends or other parts of his family. You know, music is so omnipresent now, and you know, people could think it's a bit treated a little bit like wallpaper, but I think is wonderful this summer, the fact that Running Up That Hill, A Deal With God by Kate Bush, has taken on this sort of new life with a new generation and number one in the charts, and just
as a result of a TV series called
Stranger Things. But I think what's interesting about that is it just people, you know, it wouldn't be number one for weeks without people responding to the song and what it does.
Definitely.
And the way the song is used in this series is basically this song is something she plays to connect her back with the people she loves.
Totally.
and that's it. And so that's what you can do.
Well, look, Jude Rogers, the book is The Sound of Being Human, How Music Shapes Our Lives. You're a brilliant writer. You're a Rottweiler interviewer. and you're a great, lovely person. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, both of you.
Reasons to be Cheerful with Ed Miliband and Jeff Lloyd.
Emma Corsham is our audio producer. Rachel Barmer produces all the content, books all the guests, and she's supported by Joe Kenyon at Goldfish. Gail Lofthouse is our announcer. Ed Seed, composer music. Our idents were made by James Deacon, and our artwork was designed by
Henry Cole.
He's been Ed Miliband.
He's been Jeff Lloyd.
And these have been
Reasons to be Cheerful.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Want your most burning finance and investing questions answered? Here's a podcast you should be listening to, courtesy of Acast Recommends.
Are you ready for some personality in your personal finances? Hi, I'm Janice Torres Rodriguez, Latina money expert and host of the award-winning podcast, Yo Quiero Dinero. On this show, we're serving up POC-friendly personal finance knowledge, always with a side of sass. We're not talking about avocado toast and lattes on this show. We've got real, relatable personal finance knowledge that makes you feel seen, heard, and finally understood. Consider me your super cool, slightly risque, but always honest financial fairy godmother. Together, we'll tackle dinero in a fresh new way so you can finally become poderosa with your dinero. Check out our weekly podcast episodes at YoQuieroDineroPodcast.com or subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.